This is case 68081, James Pate versus State of Nevada. Ms. Connolly, if you're ready.
My name is Karen Connolly. I represent defendant James Pate. May it please the court. Counsel, can I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal? 3 minutes. Devon Blair was a violent street bully who was stabbed to death in self-defense by the old man of the street, James Pate. In order to prove that he did not act in self-defense, it was the state's burden to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. They had to prove that Devon Blair was down, asleep, or passed out when he was stabbed by my client. In order to do that, they tried to elicit that testimony from 3 people. The first was Kristen Gramas, one of 61 certified blood spatter experts in the United States. She was not able to unequivocally state that Devon Blair was down when he was stabbed. She was not able to say that because the lead detective on the case, Clifford Mogg, had not requested that she perform the necessary workup in order to enable her to determine that he was in fact down when he was stabbed. Mightily, the state tried to obtain that testimony from Gramas. She indicated he could have been down, but he could have been getting up. Then they tried with James Dutra, the coroner. When he wouldn't give them what they needed, they then questioned Clifford Mogg. He was the lead detective, and he was more than willing to provide the testimony that the 2 experts in the case would not provide. In regard to Gramas, as I indicated, she was one of 61 certified blood splatter experts. The state questioned her. You were at the scene. She was at the scene. She saw the blood. She saw the spatter on the door. She saw the spatter on the deceased's arms. Yet she was still not unequivocally able to say he was down when he was stabbed. And there was a very important question from a juror. It was asked of Ms. Gramas, and she was asked, is it possible he was standing when he was stabbed? And she indicated it was possible. Next, the state tried to get the coroner Dutra to say that Mr. Blair was down when he was stabbed. The coroner, Mr. Dutra, spent a great deal of time, lengthy testimony, describing each of the wounds, and there was 24 wounds. They tried to get him to say Mr. Blair was down when he was stabbed. Couldn't say it. They asked him, was there any way to determine from his injuries what position he was in when he was stabbed? The coroner couldn't do it. He responded, not really. The coroner, who's the expert on wounds, and the crime scene analyst, who's a blood spatter expert, could not say he was down when he was stabbed. The state even tried to show Dutra the crime scene photos. They showed him, they pointed out the pooling of the blood, the photographs of the deceased and the pooling around his head, and they asked him, doesn't that indicate that he was down when he was stabbed? And Dutra responded, not really, it doesn't really matter. I need to know how much blood drained out of him after he was unconscious. They even tried to bring out, they were going to bring out the clothing, the bloody clothing that was in evidence. They asked Dutra, would helping the clothing, we showed you the bloody clothing. And his response was, no, that's why they're sent to the lab. He said the lab has experts in blood spatter and analyzing the scene and clothing who are qualified to determine the position of somebody on stabbed. And he indicated that on more than one occasion when he wouldn't give the state the testimony they were seeking. 2 expert witnesses, the blood spatter expert, the wounds expert, neither one would say unequivocally, which is what was required, unequivocally, when that first stab wound was inflicted, where it was done. Then it was time for Detective Mogg. And the state was able to get Detective Mogg to testify that Blair was down from the stab. And in fact, in the state's rebuttal argument, one of the last things the state said to the jury was, Detective Mogg, in all his years of experience as a homicide detective, telling you that the victim was down. The victim was down for all 24 stab wounds. No self-defense.
Do you think Detective Mogg should have been an expert witness as opposed to a lay witness giving opinion testimony.
Absolutely. And I think that that's evident from the testimony of Dutra and the testimony of Gramas. Now, the basis of Mogg's opinion was the absence of stab wounds and blood spatter. We had the two experts, the expert in wounds who painfully and extensively went through every single stab wound. They asked him about every single wound, and he still wouldn't say he was down from the stab.
Now, did you receive any disclosure from the state prior to the trial that they were going to ask Detective Mogg to give expert testimony?
Absolutely not, and that's why I'm asking you to reverse the conviction in this particular case. There was no notice whatsoever that Detective Mogg was going to provide this testimony, and I objected extensively at trial to his testimony, and the trial court determined that he would permit the testimony because it was lay opinion and not expert opinion. And I submit that, given the testimony of the two experts, and also given the case law from the Burnside case, which talks about expert testimony, what Burnside indicates is that, does the testimony concern information within the common knowledge or capable of perception by the average layperson, or does it require some specialized knowledge or skill beyond the realm of everyday experience? If it was lay opinion, Gramas could have provided it. If it was lay opinion, Dutra could have provided it, but these are two experts who were not going to be cajoled into going outside their area of expertise or talking about something they weren't qualified to render an opinion on. And again, Gramas was available. She didn't do the workup because Mogg didn't ask her to do it.
Now, Ms. Connolly, assuming the state argues that if it is error, it's harmless, what would your response to that be?
I would state just what I previously indicated was what the state said. The last thing the state said to the jury was, Detective Mogg, in all his years of experience as a homicide detective, telling you that the victim was down for all 24 stab wounds. They had to have that because this was a viable case of self-defense. There was no doubt that Devon Blair was a violent street bully. He was drunk. His blood alcohol content was above 0.20. There was testimony he'd been smoking spice all day, that he was angry, and that he had THC in his system. There was testimony that he had a reputation of being a violent bully.
Ms. Connolly, though, as to what you're asserting, as to this reputation, were there any weapons found as the deceased? Were there any assertions that he had wounds from either attempting to attack Mr. Pate or defensive wounds or anything of that nature? Or
what Mr. Pate testified to was that when he approached Mr. Blair, his intent was to ask for Vivian's cell phone. That when he approached Mr. Blair, Mr. Blair indicated to him, I'm going to kill you and your fucking bitch snitching ass punks, because they had gone to the police earlier to report Mr. Blair for beating her up. Mr. Pete testified that when he approached Mr. Blair, that he started to get up and he saw him reach for something. When he saw him reach for something, he thought it was a knife or a weapon. Now, what the crime scene showed is that there was a silver cell phone in the vicinity of Mr. Blair. So my client's belief was that one, he could not match this far younger, fitter, healthier man in a fight, and that when he got up or started to get up and threatened him and reached for something, that he was reaching for a weapon. In regard to the defensive stab wounds, that was one of the reasons why Mogg said, well, based upon the absence of defensive stab wounds, that is one of the reasons that I relied upon in reaching my opinion. However, When Dutra was asked, well, you don't see defensive stab wounds, he was still unable to definitively say, based on the absence of those stab wounds, he was down one stab.
As to the testimony by Detective Mogg and the spatter, were they inconsistent with what was provided by the other two expert witnesses, or was it a case, my understanding was they said something to the fact that they were not asked to give the due spatter?
They were not asked to do spatter, and again, in this case, in order for them to meet their burden, for the state to meet the burden of beyond a reasonable doubt wasn't self-defense, they had to have him down. Neither Dutra or Gramas, they said he could have been. They said he could have been down. He could have been moving. It was our position. We never said that he was standing. Mr. Pete never said that he was standing when he approached Mr. Blair. He said Mr. Blair was sitting on the stoop. He had a blanket around him, and then when he spoke to him, he started to get up. And Mr. Blair was higher than him because he was on a stoop, and Mr. Pete was two steps down.
But the question I asked was, were their statements inconsistent with the testimony of Detective Mogg?
I think they were inconsistent because Mogg said he was down when stabbed, and neither of those two experts said he was down when stabbed.
But they didn't say he wasn't down. They said they weren't asked to give that opinion and had not done that work, right?
They were not asked to grant a specific. Dutra said he could not make that determination. It wasn't his job. He was a coroner. He indicated there's experts at the crime scene lab who make that determination, and that would be Grammis. She couldn't do it because Mogg never asked her to do it. Grammis testified, I do what I'm told to do by the lead detective. So even though the lead detective had the blood spatter expert there at the scene, he did not ask her to do this analysis. Therefore, she could not definitively say, which is what they needed. It wasn't good enough that he could have been down, or he might have been.
But following up on my colleague's, Justice Douglas's question, let's accept that you're right. Detective Mogg went beyond what a lay witness can testify to. It was expert testimony and should have been noticed. Even crediting that, did his testimony conflict with anybody else's factually?
I don't think it conflicted. I would submit that it did conflict because nobody else said unequivocally that this man was down, and he did say that.
Yes.
And under the Jones case, what the Jones case talks about is the failure to endorse a witness's reversible error when non-disclosure results in substantial prejudice, or the state acted in bad faith. My client was substantially prejudiced by this because it was the only person, Mogg was the only person who gave the state what they needed in order to defeat the self-defense claim. In order to defeat that self-defense claim, somebody had to say, he was down one step. That was inconsistent with my client's testimony, because my client's testimony was he was sitting. He didn't say he was standing, but he was on the stoop. The only one that could contradict my client 100% was Mogg, who rendered an opinion that he wasn't qualified to render, which was extremely prejudicial to my client. And my 3 minutes. Thank you.
Ms. Beverly, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Leah Beverly, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the state of Nevada. This court should uphold Mr. Pete's conviction for first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon. First, Detective Mogg gave permissible lay witness opinion testimony in conformity with NRS 50.265 and Burnside v. State. However, even if this court were to find that Detective Mogg gave impermissible expert testimony without being noticed, Mr. Pete still cannot show that he suffered any prejudice as a result of this testimony. One thing that defense counsel noted in her argument was that it was the state's burden to prove unequivocally that he was down on the floor at the time that he was stabbed 24 times, Mr. Blair. The state had to prove that Mr. Pete was not acting in self-defense, but he certainly didn't have to be on the ground the entire time. Detective Mogg testified that Mr. Blair was on the ground at the time of his death, and that was based on two different things. First, the lack of any signs of a struggle, including lack of any signs of torn clothing, torn items, any defensive wounds. And he also testified for the second basis of his opinion that there was a lack of blood underneath the arm of where Mr. Blair was found by police. That is certainly something that a lay witness observing a body and the circumstances around the body could testify to. One thing that Ms. Connolly noted was that...
But the state went further. They talked about the 100 investigations and that they drew on his expertise, certainly in presenting that testimony. So they wanted both sides of that. I mean, I get the distinction between lay and expert witness testimony, but the state really did present him as an expert.
But it's the state's position that he was basing his opinion on his personal observations. Yes, he does have experience as a detective. Yes, that was part of the trial, but he was basing this particular opinion solely based on his observation of this particular body, including the fact that we have the blanket that was pulled all the way up to Mr. Blair's chest At the time, and that's how he was found, based on the pictures that were presented, as well as the testimony of Officer Ware, who was the first person to come upon the body. So certainly, Detective Mogg has experience as a homicide detective, but this was based on his observations of this personal scene.
But didn't he go further than just observations? He speculated as he gave opinions.
Well, I think his opinion was based on what he observed on the scene, the lack of blood underneath an arm, which I think a lay witness, using an example of an umbrella, for example, if someone has an umbrella up and it's raining outside, certainly if someone is dry underneath that umbrella, the opinion is that they must have been covered at the time. The same thing goes for Detective Mogg and his opinion that had this arm been covering something when the blood splatter was coming out, it must have been covered at the time. But even if this court were to say that Detective Mogg was testifying as an expert, there was certainly no prejudice in this case. Ms. Connolly talked about how...
Counsel, isn't the defense allowed to be prepared for that kind of testimony? That's the whole purpose of providing notice that someone's going to testify as an expert.
Understandable, Your Honor. I think that the defense was certainly on notice about that the position of the victim was going to be an issue in this case, especially regarding the photos, the testimony of Dr. Dutra, the testimony of Kristen Grammis. In fact, Dr. Dutra and Kristen Grammis both actually, Detective Mogg's testimony was merely cumulative of their testimony. In fact, even though Ms. Connolly just indicated that Coroner Dutra indicated that he couldn't definitively say whether the victim was down. In fact, he gave very damaging testimony that Mr. Blair was probably sleeping at the time and that he certainly wasn't moving based on the pattern and the thrust wounds that were observed on Mr. Blair's body. That is certainly more damaging than Detective Mogg's cumulative testimony that he was on the ground. Additionally, it was not Detective Mogg's testimony that made Mr. Pete suffer any prejudice. In fact, it was multiple things that indicated that Mr. Pete was not acting in self-defense, including Mr. Pete's own statements, not only his statements to the police that there was no defense in this case, his statements that he would pin a medal on the killer in this case. It was also the defense witness, Ms. Vivian, who indicated that the whole time she was back in the alley where Mr. Blair was found dead, he was sleeping. The video surveillance in this case indicated that Ms. Vivian walked out only a few seconds from that alley when Mr. Pete walked out, meaning that they were both there the entire time when Mr. Pete was stabbing this victim. So Vivian's testimony that he was sleeping, the surveillance video that they were walking out together, along with Dr. Dutra's testimony that he was sleeping based on the various things that he testified to, was certainly damaging to the defense and certainly proved that this was not a case of self-defense. So any testimony by Detective Mogg was cumulative. In fact, in Burnside v. State, when this court held that the cell phone custodian of records actually was presenting expert testimony, this court also held that any error in notice, lack of notice of him as an expert, was harmless based on the fact that the evidence was cumulative. And in fact, this court indicated that the remedy was not necessarily to exclude the testimony, but even if it was to exclude, it was still harmless error based on the fact that it was cumulative, and that there was other evidence pointing to the fact that the defendants in Burnside were present at the scene. The same goes in this case. The overwhelming amount of evidence in this case indicated that Mr. Blair was not only down at the time he was stabbed, but that he was in fact sleeping. We also have his high blood alcohol level, the fact that that is where he slept. Multiple people testified that this was the place that Mr. Blair slept. In this particular homeless camp, we have a testimony of Officer Ware who said the blanket was pulled up. So every other piece of evidence, including counsel's own witnesses, pointed to the fact that Mr. Blair was sleeping. So any error, it's the state's position that this was certainly lay testimony, but even if it were not lay opinion, there is certainly no prejudice suffered by Mr. Pete.
Can I ask you about one other issue that was raised by the appellant? It wasn't raised in the opening argument, but I'm interested in it. That's the juror investigation doing research. It came up after the trial was over, and I guess the defense attorneys found out about it. As you know, we had a recent case of Bowman about juror research. Do you have any thoughts why this is different than what happened in the Bowman case?
Well, I think in this particular case, when we were briefing this issue, we were relying on Meyer v. State at the time, and Meyer listed the factors regarding whether something is not only misconduct, but whether even if there is misconduct, there is any prejudice. And in this particular case, we have a very limited situation where this juror, as he testified to at the hearing on this matter, simply went back after the jury deliberations, after the closing statements, looked up a couple of definitions on Wikipedia, which is kind of like an online dictionary, and then looked up a couple of definitions of self-defense, and then came back the next morning and started deliberations. At the point where he started deliberations, the night that he went home, he didn't realize that he was going to be getting a packet of instructions detailing all the law that he would need to know. As soon as he found that out, as he testified to, he immediately disregarded anything he read on Wikipedia. He did not share any information that he looked at with his fellow jurors. In fact, he indicated that he only looked at these definitions for approximately 5 minutes. He actually indicated, in fact, that he followed the judge's instructions to the T, and that is from the eighth volume of the appendix, page 1497. He completely disregarded what he learned, and this situation is certainly not something that prejudiced Mr. P. In fact, it was the state's position in the district court that this wasn't even misconduct given prior case law. The judge ended up finding that it was misconduct, but there was no prejudice. And certainly given the factors in Meyer, there is absolutely no prejudice in this case regarding that issue.
Thank you.
Going back to some of the other issues raised by defense counsel in their opening brief, another issue I wanted to...
I want to return to Mogg for one moment. Was there any request for an adjournment or consistent with the claim that his testimony surprised the defense? Was there a request for continuance, for time to get another expert?
Thank you. There was not. There was not any request for a continuance. There were objections, obviously, to the testimony.
I know the objections.
But there was no request for a continuance, which is a remedy that in Jones v. State, the court indicated that there are a variety of remedies available if there is an issue with a notice situation.
And do we have any proffer of what kind of expert could and would have testified for the defense? Because of the shortness of time, I'm not faulting them for not having it. I just don't know what the record is on that.
I would assume that maybe they would try to maybe get a bloodstain pattern expert, but the problem with that is that any bloodstain pattern expert they could have theoretically hired would have directly contradicted what their own witnesses already testified to, and specifically I'm referring to Vivian. Vivian said multiple times in her testimony on direct and cross-examination that she was back in that alley where Mr. Blair was sleeping for an hour gathering up her stuff and cleaning up, and that the entire time she was back there, prior to going over to behind the Bank of America, he was sleeping. And what's even more concerning about Vivian's testimony is that she indicated she never, ever saw Mr. Blair attack Mr. Pete the way Mr. Pete described. Vivian's testimony and Mr. Pete's testimony was completely contradictory. Mr. Pete's testimony also that he was able to wield a knife that quickly, jump on top, and start stabbing from the abdomen up was also in contradiction to Dr. Dutra's testimony, who said the neck wounds were one of the earlier wounds. So any expert that they theoretically could have hired would have been in direct contradiction to the other evidence that was already presented by the defense during trial. Going to another thing that was raised in the appellant's opening brief was regarding the surveillance video narration of the video. Certainly there is no error regarding that based on Rosanna v. State as well as Burnside v. State. Detective Mogg had ample opportunity on other occasions other than the surveillance video to view Vivian, to view Mr. Pete. And even more, there was certainly no prejudice because Mr. Pete took the stand and indicated that that was him on the surveillance video throwing the knife onto the Tower of Jewels. There was also raised in the opening brief regarding the jury instructions on self-defense. Those instructions came directly from NRS 200.200 and Runyon v. State. They were proper recitations of the law. There was nothing in error about those. And in fact, the only instruction that was objected to was number 28, and that was directly from NRS 200.200. Finally, the last thing that I would note is regarding any error in sentencing that was raised by the appellant. There was certainly no errors in sentencing in this case. Mr. Pete's sentence fell within the prescribed range by statute. Regarding the notice of the victim speaker, in fact, pursuant to Bushchaver v. State, in fact, the type of testimony that the wife of Mr. Blair gave did not even require notice. She only gave about a three-line recitation of what her husband meant to her. She talked nothing about the facts of this case.
And he said he wanted to go ahead with sentencing anyway, correct?
Exactly. While Ms. Connolly indicated she did not want to go forward, Mr. Pete said over and over throughout that entire sentencing hearing that he wanted to go ahead and go forward. He had already been there for 2 months. He wanted to proceed. He wanted to let the victim speak. So any error that could have been there was certainly waived by Mr. Pete. And there was nothing incorrect about the PSI. And Mr. Pete's sentence, again, fell within the prescribed range by statute. And finally, just briefly regarding sufficiency of the evidence, this case was overwhelming. Every single witness talked about the amount of violence that was occurred in this case, the fact that Mr. Pete was out for revenge based on what happened to Vivian earlier in the night, the fact that Mr. Pete knew where the victim was sleeping. Mr. Pete wielded that knife, and Ms. Connolly talked about how his sole purpose was to go and get Vivian's phone back. However, the testimony came out that he never got Vivian's phone back. And that, I think, was destructive to him. The evidence in this case was overwhelming, and I would ask that you uphold the conviction. Thank you.
Your Honor indicated to opposing counsel, isn't the purpose of the notice requirement to give defense counsel notice? And that's the point in this case. And what Burnside talks about is not engaging in trial by ambush. It was their obligation to provide notice if they were going to provide expert testimony. That expert testimony substantially prejudiced my client. And I even think that we have an argument of bad faith on behalf of the state. They tried so hard over and over and over again to get Dutra and Grammas to say what they needed. Was he down on staff? And when they didn't do it, they extracted that testimony from the witness who was not qualified to provide that testimony, knowing full well that the defense had not been provided with notice. Had we been provided with notice that a blood spatter expert was going to come in and was going to present evidence to the jury that the decedent was not withstanding or his position when he was stabbed, we would have hired a spatter expert of our own. We did not do that specifically because there was no notice of expert presented.
Did you, as the question was asked, did you make a proffer to the court as to that issue?
What we did was we objected vociferously to have his testimony precluded. I do not recall that we asked for a continuance because we were in the middle of a trial, but we asked for the court to preclude over and over again to preclude the testimony of Detective Mogg in regard to that specific issue. And I don't think it's a requirement that we have to ask for continuance in the heat of the trial. What we wanted was his testimony precluded.
I understand that, but still, in terms of making your record complete, you objected, the court overruled you, and that's why I asked the question, did you assert, if you'd been given the opportunity to have additional time, whether or not you agreed with the court to offer defense to what they're saying, that was...
The best of my recollection, our objection was simply that he should be precluded, that this is prejudicial. The more focus, I believe, was the court was insisting that this was lay testimony and not expert testimony.
And how do you respond to the state's position that this is error, however, there was overwhelming evidence?
Well, I would completely disagree. There was nobody present when the incident took place. Vivian had been there previously, and she had left. And she indicated, I believe her testimony was, that he was going in and out. When she walked by, he was on the stoop with another young lady. It was after she left, my client indicated he went up to try and get Vivian's phone, because he'd never had an issue with Mr. Blair. Mr. Blair had been violent to plenty of people and had beat up plenty of people.
Complete your thought.
But never my client. So when he went up to try and get the phone, Mr. Blair was sitting up. And that's when Mr. Blair was angry, because he felt Vivian and my client had snitched him out by going to the police earlier in the day when he had violently attacked Vivian. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank counsel for Mr. Pete and the state for arguments offered this day. This is case number 68081. Matter will stand submitted.